This is a conversation with Brian Kahn, the managing editor of Earther, on climate change, the limitations of media and politics in the present, and the spirituality that the environmental movement may need to find to articulate what it truly means to live in our era of mass death and destruction. I've left this conversation relatively unedited to give you an honest viewpoint into my own thoughts as the host of the Arts of Travel podcast on the very depressing necropolitics of our times and my own critiques on how the technical and policy-driven proposals of the left fail to capture the imagination in a way that will be needed to truly redirect our attention towards stopping climate change and environmental destruction as a global public. For more conversations like this, you can listen to our back catalog on the Arts of Travel podcast. And of course, for print interviews, you can go to asiaarttours.com. We have a fascinating interview up now with Alex Martin of the Japan Times on the extinction of Japan's native wolf population and the impact this had both environmentally, but also culturally and spiritually on Japan. Here's my conversation now with Brian Kahn, the editor of Earther, on the environment, spirituality, media, and the barriers that we still face in uniting the global public against climate change. I hope you enjoy our chat today. Thank you.
My name is Brian Kahn. I am the managing editor at Earther, which is a climate and environmental justice site. And in addition to that, I also teach in the master's program in climate and society at Columbia University's Climate School, which the school actually is just new this year. So very exciting.
So this is an off-the-cuff question, but it'll be one well-versed because it's about your background. I was reading a little bit about you before this podcast, and you don't seem like a trust fund baby, or who I would sort of normally associate with a lot of the class and status inequalities that more and more journalists are, I think, aware of, that there's a lot of very rich people who go into journalism because at the start, there's a lot of money you have to put into either journalism school or just getting on your feet. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your background very briefly, and how have you risen to where you are without being a Kushner, or, you know, without having someone on, you know, the board at Yale?
Yeah, definitely nobody I know in high places, for better or worse. I think in some ways for better, but yeah, you know, my background is, I mean, if you want to go way back, I mean, I was basically raised by a single mother. We lived in apartments and even public housing. And so that's, you know, really where I come from. It's not a place of great wealth, and, you know, learned a lot of lessons, both good and hard, through that upbringing. In terms of how I sort of found my way through that, I mean, I guess, you know, one of the things that my mom did have, I mean, she had a PhD and, you know, had done that sort of academic work herself, was not working in lucrative business. She was actually a bookbinder. And so, you know, that was, but that sort of, that desire to explore in a lot of ways came from her, and figuring out, you know, my place in the world and how to make the world a better place, or at least hopefully start to try to make the world a better place. So that's basically, you know, the far back story. And I guess the more near-term story of how I ended up where I am is just sort of working up the ranks from a web editor in a job at a climate journalism nonprofit to managing editor today, and sort of putting in the work and learning journalism on the fly. My background is studying climate science and policy, so it's not a traditional journalism background by any means. And I've had to kind of pick up the ropes as I go, and have been lucky enough to have bosses and coworkers and friends who have helped me along the way to figure out, you know, how this field works.
So we're going to start with the pessimism of the intellect, and then we'll go to optimism of the will for the flip side of this. But I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about my own dissatisfaction with a lot of climate journalism is that for the most part, it seems like it's written by who it is written by, which is usually white people. Oftentimes, you know, the higher the pay the publication or the prestige of the publication, probably the further distance they'll actually have from the real violence of climate change. So, you know, like Louisiana, for example, we're going to read tons about restoring the French Quarter, but in terms of a lot of the marginalized communities, that probably won't be a focal point of, let's, you know, say most major publications like the New York Times. Similarly, most of these publications will root themselves in the institutions that brought us to this tipping point. So looking at institutions like Harvard, Columbia, Yale, and so on, or looking to, let's say, the policy of a Biden administration. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how orthodoxy based on class or upbringing maybe is a hindrance, if it's fair to make that critique with caveats, of media, and how could outsider perspectives help us better understand what we need to do to address climate change?
I mean, you know, it's certainly, I think it can be a blind spot for sure. Certainly in a lot of the larger legacy media outlets that you mentioned, I mean, that is a concern. And I mean, that said, there are wonderful people doing journalism there, putting in the work. There are people from diverse backgrounds, although by all accounts from those folks that I've talked to, I mean, it's not super easy to be on the inside. I think that when it comes to doing good journalism, and particularly doing good journalism around the climate crisis, you know, the answer to how to do that is, you know, multiple perspectives and people that think about things differently. I mean, if there's one thing that we've seen, it's that the orthodoxy of approaching this problem has led to, you know, this very dangerous place that we're in now, where time is short to really mitigate emissions and turn things around before we start to have really, really catastrophic impacts. And I don't say that to be like, you know, we need to think about the future. I mean, we need to think about the present too, because the reality is the present right now, I mean, we're seeing the impacts of 1 degree of warming globally, and those impacts are horrifying, and they're dangerous, and they're deadly to people that are living on the front lines of this. So, you know, in terms of like the role of journalism and the role it can play in sort of getting that ship right, I mean, a big part of that is being representative and telling stories and finding people to tell those stories that have lived through these things, that can make them clear, that can be inclusive, and that can talk about this as more than just, you know, this meta problem of, you know, like we need to rebuild the French Quarter, which, you know, is great. Like we need to protect everywhere, but protect those communities that are outside the levees in New Orleans, that were on the front lines of Ida, that have seen the storm surge, that have seen, you know, people die in the aftermath because they don't have access to electricity right now. And it's been Louisiana has been under an excessive heat warning for, you know, weeks after Ida. I mean, these are stories that really matter. And so when it comes down to it, I mean, I think journalism as a whole can really benefit from better representation. And, you know, I think it's really incumbent on those of us in journalism, particularly in positions of power that can do hiring, to think about that holistically as they're thinking about how to tell this story the best way that they can. And, you know, think about what the solutions are that we actually need and who has to be at the table, because that, you know, is also, that's a big part of the story too. And who has traditionally not been included and who should, you know, we be thinking about including in the conversation now.
So it sounds like both you and I at certain points have been poor. And I say that because for me, a lot of climate journalism is the same as a lot of journalism on class, where if you've been poor, if you faced climate violence, you oftentimes don't need to hear it. It's just getting something sort of told back to you. And moreover, particularly for global problems, I think something I've grown accustomed to, sadly, in media is a lot of stories that are very atomizing, that will focus on, let's say, one community or one issue, but not really give a sense of how these communities can come together in intersectional and linked ways. So that's my critique of climate journalism as I've traditionally seen it practiced. You know, Roy Scranton, you read it and you just go, huh, okay, we're doomed. Well, all right, who gives a fuck? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk about your own perspectives on some of the issues you've had without, you don't have to name names, but some of the issues you've had traditionally with climate change journalism, as well as this idea of why are so many stories about climate change, why do they leave us feel more atomized as opposed to feeling like we're all in it together?
I guess, you know, some of the issues. So I will say like that I do feel that there have been great strides made. I mean, obviously not far enough, but like certainly there have been steps taken in recent years to rectify some of the ills of climate journalism. I mean, they're the narratives of it's in the future and we should think about that. I mean, those are being put to bed, and they're being put to bed partly because journalists are paying attention and partly because, I mean, the world is telling us that. You know, I think, so that's certainly one thing. I mean, a really intense focus on the science and the data. I mean, those things, again, still very important. And I think we need them for decision-making purposes. And there's certainly people out there that like really relate to that stuff. And that is amazing for them. But I think that these stories about communities being impacted and people working on the solutions, movements that are building around this, those stories have become more prominent in recent years as well. And, you know, there needs to be, I think, more of that, to your point about, you know, this idea of atomization. To a degree, I think that, you know, every community has its own unique story to tell, and everyone deals with these impacts differently. And, you know, there is value in exploring the uniqueness of how different people are thinking about the problems and the solutions here, and experiencing these impacts. But I do agree that like there is some value in trying, and I think one of the challenges is like figuring out how do we step back and also talk about the bigger movements afoot and the commonalities that link up these places. I mean, that is a really fine line to walk in journalism, because it's, on the one hand, it's really easy to write about like the big thing, you know, from like 30,000 feet. On the other hand, it's really, not easy, but it's, you can zoom into the ground level and do a lot of work in that area as far as reporting goes. But the area that you're talking about, which I feel like is more maybe like to keep our, you know, elevation analogy going, like, you know, the 5,000 foot level, that is a real challenging place to report from. Just because, you know, it's like, you got to get a story that people can latch onto, and that requires a little bit of granularity, but you need to share the bigger picture, and that can require zooming out. So I think, you know, that's an area that is, I mean, just as a journalist, like it's a really tough place to report from and do stories that maybe, you know, connect people up with the ideas of what it looks like to look at the world from there and find their way to be part of that, you know, that kind of space, you know, to get in that mindset and to be part of a movement or whatever it might be there. So I guess, yeah, you know, the answer is like that kind of journalism is hard to do. And I'm trying to think if there's anyone that like I would say is doing that great. And I mean, there probably is. And if their name is not coming to mind at this exact moment. So I think that speaks to the rarity of being able to report from there.
Well, it's a sad moment of timeliness that Barry Lopez, you know, has died on the couple of days before this conversation. You know, Barry Lopez, for people who don't know, in my opinion, wrote one of the best environmental books of all time with Arctic Dreams. Something that I've really been bothered by with climate journalism, and this is the last critique and it'll come in a positive light at the end, is this idea of we have to be technical. We have to be journalists. It's too much of the nerds and not enough of the hippies. A lot of my issues with climate journalism is it reads like numbers and stats, and how most people interact with nature is, you know, the water's coming into my kitchen, or, you know, the orangutans that I used to love are no more because they've been, their environment's been cut down for a palm oil plantation. So I think the coverage at Earther, from what I can see, does a pretty good job of trying to mix the more ephemeral and dare I say spiritual with this more sort of granular coverage. But I'm wondering, just broadly talking to future journalists or in your role as editor, how do you talk to people about being a journalist, but also being honest with their feelings, or also being honest about you know, admitting the pain when you go see a devastated landscape. How do you, as an editor, I guess, teach people to strike this balance between hippie-ish or hippiedom and nerddom, if I can end on a sort of funny, flippant point?
I mean, I think that we err towards, if we're gonna use those as our two poles, I think we err towards the hippiedom side. But I mean, I think that, you know, for me, I mean, I've been working in the climate space for over a decade, and it is kind of, I mean, a lot of that. So my initial, what drew me to climate was I was a big ski bum. I was a park ranger. I was, I guess, yeah, the quintessential like hippie guy, right? It's like, that was the deal. And I knew that snow was disappearing, and I knew that this resource that I really cared for, in Crater Lake National Park, was in trouble because of that. I need to figure it out. And so it's kind of interesting. Like, I had that real hippie, I guess, standpoint, and went back to school and got the real nerd data standpoint to really understand it. And, you know, now 10 years into it, I mean, it's like, it's back to Hippieville, I guess. And I think for, you know, me and the people I talk to, and certainly, you know, in talking with our staff, that's a big part of it, is like dealing with that emotional gravity of the situation. It's hard to go through a week, or certainly, you know, not even a week, but it's hard to go through the summer that we just went through, and you constantly cover the ins and outs of a heat wave in the Northwest that was considered a mass fatality event. You know, Hurricane Ida and the damage it did to the Gulf in the Northeast, floods in Detroit, floods in Tennessee, the drought in California. Like, these things are all like, these are all numbers things on one level, right? Like, the storm was a category 4, the floods brought 17 inches of rain. Like, there's numbers there, right? But like, at the end of the day, like, that, those are human stories. And so I think for us, like, that's always been the challenge, is like making sure that you're trying to connect with both sides of that, because some people are going to engage with the nerd stuff. Some people really do will latch on when you say it rained 17 inches in 24 hours in this one county in Tennessee. Someone's going to pick that up. Or you say it was a 1 in 500 year flood, like, that will connect with someone. And I don't begrudge them that. I mean, I think it's great that people can relate to numbers, but I do think that, like, when it comes down to it, like, we also need to talk about like the toll that this is taking on humanity and like the natural world, and the fact that like certain systems are collapsing or on the brink of collapse. And that is a real existential loss for us as humans and for the natural world. And I mean, frankly, like, I don't view us as outside that natural space. So it's just a collective loss that we also need to figure out how to talk about and understand and process.
And on the hippie-ish side, I'm more of a hippie, I think you can probably tell. But your story about the loss of quiet, I believe it was the Ho rainforest, which is, I had never heard of until I went. And it's like one of, you're like dead. You've like died, and like, you're in a screensaver, basically. It's one of the most beautiful ecosystems I've seen as a world traveler. But that was, that was a beautiful. Could you just, I brought it up enough. Could you explain the story of the Ho rainforest and this loss of quiet as, perhaps an example of what will come up throughout this conversation of sort of the more spiritual and ephemeral, the meanings that we lose as climates collapse? If you don't mind talking about that story, in brief.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's one of my all time favorite pieces I've ever written. Like, I don't praise myself very often, or like think like fondly about, you know, stories I've written. Like, there are very few stories I think of being like, oh, that one. But that was one of those pieces where I just, reporting it, writing it, like everything about it, like I loved every second of it and wish I could just like have that every day of my life. But basically, yeah, so the Ho rainforest is located in Olympic National Park in Washington. It is basically the only stretch of temperate rainforest in the lower 48. It's one of the most just unreal landscapes. I mean, everything is green. There are rivers that run through it. There are stunning trees, wildlife. I mean, it's truly a magical place, like visually. But what really makes it unique is sonically, it's also a really special place. It's considered to be the quietest place in the lower 48. So that's an amazing natural resource to have. And yet there is an incredible conflict over it, namely that the Navy is flying its loudest fighter jets over the rainforest as part of a warfare training zone. And these jets are jets that are essentially their radar jammers. So they have to fly really low and they are unbelievably loud. I mean, when you talk about screaming fighter jets, like that is it. And so there's this conflict there of activists that are trying to preserve the quiet of the rainforest and the Navy that is training for warfare over the rainforest. And it's just absolutely one of the most outlandish conflicts that you could imagine. I mean, it's absurd to even think about. And so, you know, I mean, this fight over it is wild, and it's wild not just because people are like, I want my peace and quiet, although they certainly want that, but it's also because, I mean, there's something certainly sacred about this quiet, but there's also something about the fact that this quiet is essential for nature to continue existing as it has. Owls are unable to hunt when there's noise. Creatures, you know, squirrels, deer, everything, they change their habits when there's noise. They get stressed. The pollution, noise pollution actually, you know, can take years off of our lives and certainly affects animals in negative ways too. And so, you know, when reporting that story and being out there, I mean, it's just one of those things where experiencing the silence, standing at this one location that has been sort of dubbed the one square inch of silence, and then imagining and then even hearing commercial jets fly over, you know, at 30,000 feet. I mean, it's truly one of the most just like disconnecting, like one of those two things, there are things that just don't connect in your brain that shouldn't happen, right? Like there should not be this noise in this place. And so, you know, when we talk about like the natural world and the hippie side things, I mean, that is it. But I think that, you know, it goes beyond that. I mean, it really is about like preserving these ecosystems, but also preserving what is a part of, you know, this plant that we call home. I mean, to be frankly, it's about us being part of this as well, and not just about like, oh, doing it for the animal's sake, but doing it to have something that is whole and special.
So I'm wondering if you could just talk about, and you don't need to agree with me, I hope that, you know, AOC will save us. I don't believe that personally, but okay, for people who do, I'm not omnipotent. But what insights have you gained from this sort of paradox of the action to save workers' lives under COVID, whereas those same workers for climate change, most governments are telling them to go get fucked.
So one thing I think about with this regard, just the comparison, I think where one thing that really that stands out to me is that, you know, developed countries did do these very rigid top-down, you know, solutions, and there was this far-right backlash. And I'll circle back to that in a second. But I do think like it also is really telling that, you know, in terms of like vaccine parity and things like that, that's where, you know, that's where we've seen the big divide happen again, that some people, I mean, certainly in this country, in the US, folks are, sorry, there's a car driving by that's like rattling my windows. New York life.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. So, I mean, in this country, like, I mean, the fact vaccine access, I mean, it's everywhere, but it's been really, you know, the push to like, the sort of wishy-washy approaches to intellectual property, and should those vaccines become available to poorer folks? How does this go about? How does the COVAX consortium work? Like, these things have all been kind of like, eh. And I feel like that in many ways mirrors like the response to climate change that, you know, I mean, certainly there's the microcosm in this country where we look at something like, you know, just Ida to again focus on something recent, but, you know, we look at Ida where dozens of people died in illegal basement dwellings here in New York. The communities that are in the outskirts, you know, beyond New Orleans that, you know, haven't gotten the same media attention are still suffering and trying to rebuild. And, you know, there's still tens of thousands of people without power a couple of weeks after the storm passed through. So there are those inequalities playing out, you know, on climate and the COVID front. That I think are really telling. The other thing that I think has given me a lot of pause in watching the COVID response and like the far right backlash to lockdowns, or, you know, quote unquote lockdowns. I mean, I guess some areas maybe a little more lockdown than others, but like it wasn't like the end of the world, or the backlash to vaccines or wearing masks and infringement on personal freedom and things like that. I think what's really sort of scary to see about that and then map it on to climate change is that, you know, like you look at that and you look at the, I guess, the tendencies towards like nationalism and nativism and the ideas of building walls and locking people out and hoarding, you know, I mean, essentially like you're hoarding these resources here in the US. That to me, and thinking about like what does climate change look like if we don't sort of get a handle on it, if we sort of view it as like, you know, oh, like both sides have like equally good ideas, is that the far right forces that are already kind of working their way through both popular society and the government, I mean, the response to climate change is not going to be good. I mean, we've seen what it looks like with COVID. It's, you know, these violent backlashes against any kind of mandates. And then we've also seen what it looks like over the past, you know, over the four previous years of the Trump administration, which is build the wall and lock folks up in detention centers. I mean, that's admittedly still continuing under Joe Biden, but I think that it really does speak to the sort of risks that as climate change worsens, if we don't address it, even if we do potentially address it, we don't do it fast enough, we could see these really extremist response from the right. And so, you know, I guess that's maybe a long way of answering of like, looking at, like, I see some parallels, and some of the parallels are disconcerting, to say the least.
Sure. I think the unspoken part of that question, though, is where is the left? And I've brought up the ghost of Met Gala AOC once. What are your thoughts on the left and where you've been disappointed? And it's fine to be hopeful again for voting, but do you see hope for the idea of being a participant in this form of democracy? Will be able to bring about something that is incrementally better or transformatively better?
Some of those things are already happening. I mean, you can see some of the ideas that have been championed as part of a Green New Deal being, I mean, we'll see what happens. And if the reconciliation bill even passes, you know, makes it to the floor, all that, but certainly some of like the ideals that are in the Green New Deal, like the Climate Conservation Corps, are in there. I mean, there are progressive things that are happening on climate that wouldn't have happened, in my estimation, at least, without having a congressional constituency that is progressive, democratic, socialist, and without a movement outside of it, like Youth Climate Strikers and Sunrise Movement and others, certainly Indigenous rights movement, pushing for these kinds of things. I mean, you know, the whole like Overton window thing is, I mean, it's, you know, overused in way of cliche at this point, but in many ways, like, it has happened. I think that when we're talking, you know, there's this kind of tendency to frame climate on a spectrum of left to right and not, you know, what's adequate versus inadequate. I mean, but if we're going to just frame it, you know, in that sort of left to right spectrum, like, the window has certainly shifted to the left. And I think that, you know, when it does that, I mean, there's certainly political ramifications, but there is also just like a fact that like there is an adequate response to climate that does require a very big all of government kind of approach to it. So, yeah, you know, I mean, the things that there are certainly signs that there is a climate left sort of renaissance that's happening. It's making its way into the mainstream. That bodes well for, you know, at least like starting to do some things about climate after just really kind of being on autopilot for essentially forever, more or less. But, you know, the challenges still remain. And so I think it's kind of incumbent on, if folks are really wanting to see serious climate action, to see emissions come down, to see frontline communities protected, to see job opportunities for the next generation of folks coming up, and a just transition for fossil fuel workers, like these kinds of things. If like folks really want to see that, then yeah, like the turnout, in spite of all the roadblocks that have been tossed up to voting rights, is going to be really important in the next, you know, in the midterms and beyond.
I'm going to take a break from politics for a second. And something I wanted to ask you as an editor, we talk about sort of the craft of journalism. Let's say Earther is like we talked about for your beautiful piece about the whole rainforest, he's able to do these more long form stories year after year. Let's say one year I send a reporter to cover Hurricane Ida. They come back with a tragic piece of ignorance and injustice, these flooded basements. The next year it's Hurricane Dennis and it's the Florida Panhandle, the same suffering. The next year it's Hurricane Maud, South Carolina, the same suffering. And I'm wondering, I don't ever see this talked about a lot, I think because as Americans, we are fucked up. But when it comes to this idea of trauma and being open to suffering and pain, while at the same time having to execute the role of a journalist, which is to faithfully retell a story and perspective, perhaps as a larger narrative arc or explainer about why the way the world is how it is. What advice do you give between this sort of divide between giving into the emotional versus staying factual? And how have you sort of learned personally to better straddle it and explore it within your own work?
It's impossible to really separate. Well, I think for some journalists, it probably is possible to separate those things out. I think, at least with me, I mean, I can certainly speak to myself more than anyone else, but I would also venture to guess that it's true for some climate journalists as well, that it's becoming harder to disentangle your emotions about the story from what's happening in the world. I mean, there are certainly positive stories about climate that we can write and like amazing developments that are happening and like heat pump technology, for example, which is like nerdy, but great. So I think that like, you know, there are certainly good and uplifting stories to tell, but there are also, I mean, yeah, like it takes a toll. And I think that in some ways, you know, really can inform reporting, you know, being factual and dealing with the emotional, I mean, frankly, like trauma sometimes of covering these events or these stories or people's lives. You know, those things can go hand in hand. And I think, in fact, that they should go hand in hand. I mean, being a journalist and being objective is important, right? But I think that, you know, one of the most important traits that I have tried to develop as a journalist and as a human being, and I think that anyone in this field should be working towards, is empathy. You know, we certainly, like, I think it's something that is never, you can never have enough of it, frankly. And it's really important to me to have that when I'm approaching a story, whether it's empathy for the people that I'm interviewing, for the place that I know has been hit by a hurricane that I can't get to, for, you know, the natural world that has lost something or is on the brink of losing something. That is a really important thing to tap into. And I think can really propel a story forward to have a different, you know, resonance than just like the factual bone dry report. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to be like, insert yourself into the piece and like, make it like, I did this, I did that. It doesn't mean that, you know, you have to, you know, become some kind of like radical activist in telling that story. But I really do think that it helps like make sure that stories hit home. And I think it's honestly good for the soul in some ways, because trying to stay above it, I mean, I don't really, maybe that serves some folks well in their craft and in the art of journalism. But I don't think that for me is personally a proposition that is possible. And I think that, in fact, like being engaged will help you tell a better story.
This idea, I think, of staying above the fray as the world dies, I think it's idiotic. And I hope that more journalists in these beautiful technical explainers, like they're beautifully technically, a lot of the reporting on climate change, but I think there's much greater room for the emotional. And with the rise of what I think you hinted at, which some people have dubbed eco-fascism, this rise of how, let's say, a ascendant right, Trump 2024 is not outside the realm of possibility, nor is the continuation of the rule of Boris Johnson, Scott Morrison, and Narendra Modi. And with the rise of the global right, I'm very curious about how they will deal with climate change, which I think will be horrific for everyone who's not a part of their ethno-nationalist agendas, but also how abolitionism will evolve. Recently, for some abolitionist movements, in particular, the building of a movement against a police training center in one of Atlanta's more well-preserved forests, as well as, I think, The Intercept's, at the time, outstanding coverage of the Standing Rock protests and the violence they faced from Tiger Swan. It's very interesting to think about if ecofascism is something we're going to have to deal with, what will be the green abolitionism, as I call it, and I'm sure that's already been dubbed, but the green abolitionism that will rise to oppose it. And I'm wondering, you've been exposed to probably some of the most powerful Black Lives Matter protests in the country, as well as some of the most prominent abolitionist movements with some of the movements to close Rikers Island. What have your thoughts been about this concept of green abolitionism, and how do you think it will come to prominence if you do in the near-term future?
think there's a lot of common ground there. I mean, there's certainly, you know, I mean, Rikers is a prime example of that, of the injustice of what has transpired on that island. And I think that, you know, like when one of the plans for that, the island is, you know, to shut down the prison and then install clean energy facility there to generate solar power. And I think that, you know, that shows to, that is certainly, you know, one of the most direct connections that you can possibly imagine as far as like, you know, linking abolition to clean energy. But there, it's hardly the only example. I mean, there's a movement to get firefighters. So there are incarcerated firefighters are among the thousands of folks that are battling wildfires in California right now and around the country, but particularly in California. They have a particularly notorious program where they get paid very low wages. And it's, again, one of those things where, you know, maybe the long-term goal is full prison abolition, but there is a real big push right now to get those firefighters, once they're released, to be able to become full-time firefighters, to receive full pay, to do, you know, to basically reenter society, doing the job that they've potentially been doing behind bars for, you know, months, if not years. So I think that there is a lot of, you know, like these sort of direct examples of the ways that climate change and prison abolition can connect. I mean, longer term, I think that that is, you know, as far as if these movements, you know, sort of come to a head, I mean, that's going to be the big thing, is like, can, you know, the movement for racial justice and the movement for climate justice come together and find common ground? It seems like that is something that's happening, but in terms of, you know, thinking like longer, like, you know, let's say 5 years, 10 years down the road, I mean, if we do see far right climate policies come into play and they turn out to be eco-fascism, as, you know, that's the term that's used, and, you know, what does it look like to see pushback? I mean, if I think that that is the answer, like those groups will either come together and find a, you know, strong united resistance, or they won't, and we'll potentially be facing some pretty bleak times.
I if I could figure out a way to do it, I would say at the start of this episode ago, this podcast is brought to you by First Reformed, which I don't know if Paul Schrader was intending to do it, but for me is one of the best movies about my own views of environmentalism, where I don't feel the systems we have in place can save us. I feel they're sort of structurally damned in terms of their relationship to the environment. The philosopher and political scientist Raj Patel of the University of Texas talks a lot about like Descartes and how this evolution of thought in imperialist Europe as nature as a tool versus indigenous thought of nature as part of larger systems, of which human beings are one small part. So when I look to figures like Jessica Resnick, when I look to direct action, even things like the Earth Liberation Front, which I do think was misguided, but was a direct action that was very dramatic. I'm wondering what your thoughts in terms of editing those types of stories and writing about those types of stories are. In particular, yeah, I'm Armenian. And whenever I talk to, let's say, I have a Jewish podcast guest and this subject of like existence comes up, this idea, at least for Armenians, this is not a long story, I'm not going to do the whole Armenian genocide, but the person who assassinated the man responsible for the Armenian genocide, it was this huge philosophical uproar at the time of his existence of how does this man who murdered a million walk free while the man who assassinated him is tried for murder? And when I look at climate activists, I feel the same energy. The Biden administration, Trump and Obama have targeted these people with charges of terrorism or very extreme prosecution for damaging pipelines. And I look at that and I go, you know, how are these people who are trying to save millions of lives with their direct action, however inconsequential it may be, how is that a crime that's more severe than the petroleum industry and what it's doing to destroy our natural world? That's my own poetic weird flourish. I don't really mind if you don't agree with that, but what have your thoughts been as an editor about reporting on stories of direct action? And for you, as a thinker of climate change, what do you think will be the future of these more direct confrontations with things like the petroleum industry if legislators are unwilling to initiate change through policy?
I mean, when it comes to covering the direct action stuff, I think it's really, I mean, I think those stories are important. I mean, they're designed to be, direct action is designed to be a story in some ways, right? I mean, it's more than that, but if you're a journalist and you look through that lens, then sure, that's what it is, right? It's a confrontation between two forces. And so it's a really important story to tell. And I think that, you know, what we've seen over the past, I mean, couple of years is this escalation, not just in the number of actions, although certainly, you know, between the global climate strikes and protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, Line 3, Keystone XL, Trans Mountain, like I could rattle off probably a dozen more. We'd be here all night, but I won't do that to us. But I think that you're seeing more united resistance against these pipelines. But unfortunately, I think what you're also seeing is united resistance or united pushback by the industry and by those that are kind of its enablers in the halls of power. So many, you know, dozens of states now have what they've dubbed critical infrastructure laws that essentially have a special penalty of criminalization for protest against things like pipelines or refineries or whatever it might be, you know, shipping terminals for fossil fuels. And some of them are incredibly extreme. I mean, Montana just passed one this year. That's one of the most extreme in the country. And it not only applies to individuals that are involved who could be fined up to six figures, but it also applies to any organizations that, you know, quote unquote, I mean, I don't think the bill uses this exact language, but, you know, aid and abet, essentially act as conspirators, which is, you know, an incredibly chilling thing to free speech to see, because suddenly, you know, these small local nonprofits or maybe even bigger ones that want to, you know, put some skin in the game, if they are seen supporting a protest against a fossil fuel pipeline in Montana, suddenly they could be on the hook for a humongous fine and a long lasting criminal investigation, legal bills, all that stuff. And so, you know, in terms of what happens here, I mean, we're at a point where it feels like two major forces are afoot. I mean, lawmakers and the fossil fuel industry, and the lawmakers that are aligned with it are ready to push back with the weight of the state. And certainly, you know, fossil fuel companies, while they may not be as rich as they once were, still have pretty plentiful resources. And as you mentioned, Tiger Swan, a private security contractor, was brought in for the Dakota Access protest. It's possible that we could see that with other protests as well. So you have that force, but on the other hand, you have a majority of civil society that has said we need to leave this stuff in the ground. And you have all the science saying we need to leave this stuff in the ground. And so what does the future hold? I mean, I think it holds more escalation potentially by both sides. And I think that it also, you know, beyond the alignment that the fossil fuel industry has with the police, I mean, with lawmakers, they also have a very close relationship with police forces, whether it's through donations to buy equipment or with just direct contacts. I mean, we've seen with the protest against Line 3, that Enbridge is essentially paying the bills of cops there to, you know, help provide security for the pipeline that's being built. And so, you know, these are public records requests. They're available. Anyone can go find them. You can find reporting in Earther or in the wonderful newsletter he did and see what that situation looks like. I'm sure there are a lot of local outlets on that as well. And I don't mean to throw shade to them. Those are just the two that jump to mind. But I think that again points to like the fact that, you know, this alliance against these protests doesn't just span between lawmakers and fossil fuel interests, but also, you know, law enforcement itself. And so it's going to require this bigger systemic change than just not getting these laws on the books or, you know, getting keep it in the ground to be more of a policy. I mean, it's going to require big shifts. And so, I mean, how that plays out in the coming years, TBD. These are powerful forces and they're reaching, you know, they're escalating now, and it's going to reach an even more intense point as we get further into what has to be the end of the fossil fuel industry.
So to conclude, Brian, and it was wonderful talking to you. I really appreciate, I know it's intense when podcasts are intense. I'm not intense at you. These are awful conversations to have. About managing a global death. It's dark. To end on a note I don't often hear discussed with climate, and I had mentioned the film First Reformed, I'm going to ask a quick question, then give a quick part two. How do you see climate change impacting faith? So the movie First Reformed, for people who don't know, is a priest who, after encountering a climate activist, enters into a deep spiritual crisis about suffering and destruction on Earth. And I've been very curious that outside of very few articles, I've not encountered a lot of spirituality as it relates to environmentalism and climate change. The part two is just very quick. Like a lot of creative types, I've suffered from massive depression my whole life. And I went into the woods of Taiwan one day. I don't know what I was going to do, but it wasn't good to myself. And as I was about to do it or contemplate doing it more seriously, what they call a black serpent eagle flew overhead through these ancient cedar trees and gave out this loud caw, sort of an interruption to my thoughts of self-demise. And those moments sort of keep me alive in the most, for the most part, these encounters with nature that are unexplainable and a reminder of the spectacular beauty that exists in this world. So for part one, could you talk a little bit about any thoughts you've had about the role climate change will have on religion and faith? And then for part two, have you yourself encountered something that is spiritual or beyond explanation or deeply meaningful about nature that you'd like to share with any listeners?
With regards to climate and faith, I mean, to be honest with me, I'm not a person of deep faith myself, and I hesitate to speak for that impact just because I think there are others closer to that than I am and would probably be able to answer it more coherently and thoughtfully than I ever could. You know, I do think though that there is this, so I say that as like, you know, that's the caveat. So the answer that I would say though is that I think that, you know, when it comes to climate change and when it comes to this moment, I think it's really incumbent. And I think, you know, this also started with the coronavirus, with the pandemic last year, is there was this meme that was going around, you know, humans are the virus. And that was the meme that was really popular. And I wrote this piece last year and I still really believe it. And I don't think I'll ever not believe it because I think it's true, which is that, you know, we are not the virus, we're a part of nature. And I think that a big part of that meme was because we've sort of forgotten that. And so when it comes down to the spiritual side of things and thinking about maybe not how climate change exactly influenced faith specifically, but something that I think is really valuable to think of from a more, you know, sort of spiritual or esoteric level is just the fact that we really need to rediscover that connection. We really need to think about it and what that means and what it means to have, you know, gotten to this point where we're disconnected, where we have filled the atmosphere with danger to us into the natural world. And what does it mean to repair that relationship and treat it the right way? And so, you know, for some folks that may be a spiritual thing, for others it may be something else. But that to me is a really essential part of this whole process of addressing this problem, is coming to terms with our relationship with nature, our role in it, and fixing what has been done wrong and figuring out how to, you know, really grieve if that's what people need to do for what's been lost. So yeah, that would be, that's the caveated answer to part one. I mean, as far as moments that really meant something to me, going to the one square inch of silence was probably one of the more profound things that I've ever had happen when I've been in the natural world. And, you know, I knew I was going, and there is this kind of like cathedral-like quality to the space that is the one square inch. If anyone wants to go visit it, I'd say Google one square inch of silence, and the coordinates are available on the website documenting it, and you can experience this as well. But, you know, walking into it did feel really hallowed, and it felt really special. And there was this moment where, you know, I'd gone out with a group of people, you know, some local activists, and this sound, you know, acoustic expert, Gordon Hempton, who is the person that sort of dubbed this the 1 square inch of silence. So we all kind of went out together, and then they all kind of peeled off and went back out onto the trail. And they just, like, you know, sort of gave me this like signal, like, stay, like, experience it, be here. And I did. And it was just, I mean, there's no other way to describe it than transcendental. It was just one of the most moving experiences of my life. And it was one of, you know, I mean, I was a park ranger. I spent a lot of time in nature. I love hiking, all that stuff. But just to be there alone in this moment was unreal. And one of the greatest things that came out of that, aside from writing that story, was, so Gordon marks the square inch with a basically square inch size red rock. There's a whole story behind it, but without going to the whole long story, he changes the rock every time he goes out. And so he brought out another small 1 square inch red rock to put in place on this log amidst the moss. And he picks up the other one, and, you know, no one's talking. Like, we all agree that we'd be silent while we're out there. And he just turns to me and hands the old rock, the rock that was there when we got it, puts it in my hand, closes my hand, and that was it. And so I actually still have the rock. I brought it home with me, and it's one of the most amazing things to know that I have. I'm not a big possessions kind of guy. I don't really like get too fixated on material things, but it's something a little bit more than material, I guess. It's physical, but it's more than that. So I guess the long answer is that, you know, there is this really amazing moment at the 1 square inch. And what's truly, I guess, like, transcendental is the fact that I get to hold on to a piece that, even here in the middle of noisy New York.
Well, Brian, podcasts that feel good sort of feel like a campfire, where you're just sort of huddling around, telling stories to pass the time. I think we get a lot more successful policies if instead of Camp Davids, we had campfires. So I really appreciated this conversation. I know it maybe was more intimate and tinged with the spiritual than you were expecting, but as was the theme throughout, I don't feel, to quote the great Audre Lorde, the master's tools can really disassemble the master's house. And I think particularly for journalists like you, who I'm fond of, otherwise I wouldn't have interviewed you, it's important to sort of ask these questions, because I'm not sure if journalism in its present form can tell the full scope and weight of climate change. And it's always interesting to talk to people on the inside about what they think and believe. For more of your writing and your storytelling and your fact nerdy reporting, because there are nerds out there, and that's okay, we love them too, where can people find your work? And would you want to just shout out one particular story that we didn't have time to get to?
Yeah, I mean, so they can find my work on earther.com. That will direct you to our site. And if there was one story that I would shout out that we didn't get to talk about, it was an equally actually profound story that I got to work on, which was a story about going to dig a green grave. I helped dig a green grave in upstate New York. And similarly, just powerful, unreal experience to be standing in the woods and digging what would eventually be a grave, and understanding what that meant to have not just a, you know, green burial, but a conservation burial, and what that means for the planet. So I encourage everyone, if you want to learn about green graves, take a look at, what was the title? Digging a Green Grave Helped Me Learn About the Dirty Death Industry. Very catchy. Great video to boot with it.